Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. This is Larry Warren along with my co-host, Doug Wells. Doug, welcome back from a week's vacation.
Thank you. It was fine. I was in Cleveland, of all places.
Well, it's home. So.
Yep, that's where I grew up.
You must have seen...
And I came home to tropical weather. I couldn't believe it. It was 60 degrees in Salt Lake City yesterday.
And partly sunny skies today, heading for a high of 48. Well, it would make it a great day to be out skiing, but not until you listen to the Mountain Money program this morning, which is going to be interesting, especially looking forward to talking to our first guest, Winthrop Smith Jr., author of a book, new book, Catching Lightning in a Bottle, How Merrill Lynch Revolutionized the Financial World. And Merrill Lynch rose to become one of the biggest brokerage firms on the face of the earth. And the whole name is Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner, and Smith. And this is the son of the Smith who started it. So Winthrop Smith Jr. will be talking to us in the first half of the program.
It's going to be a fascinating story. Larry, as you say, they grew to be one of the largest firms in the world, and then over the course of 6 years, almost went out of business. And Wynn's going to tell us part of that story. Our second guest is going to be Matt Green. He's the manager of Rock and Riley's, which is a new pub on Main Street. It's on 4th and Main Street. And then our final guest is going to be Marcy Gorsh. She's the owner of Wasatch Tea Company. She's a tea master, and she's right here in Park City as well in Snow Creek Shopping Center. And we're going to talk to her about her experiences and her store. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
This is Sean Railton. I'm an agent with Park City Realty Group. I'm a 30-year Park City resident and a KPCW underwriter. I have been involved in the Park City real estate market since 1994 as an agent, an appraiser, and an investor. I can be reached at 649-1991 or Sean at ParkCityRealtyGroup.com.
Underwriting on KPCW is supported by Mountain West Bank in Park City, a community bank offering home financing service and guidance. Mountain West Bank is located near Kearns Boulevard next to the movie theater. More information at MountainWestBank.com. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And welcome back to Mountain Money here on KPCW. And we want to welcome to Mountain Money now Winthrop Smith Jr., author of Catching Lightning in a Bottle, How Merrill Lynch Revolutionized the Financial World. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Larry. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Well, you are an interesting man, both for your career at Merrill Lynch, and we are in a ski town of some renown, and you're in the ski business now, and we'll talk about that later. But let's talk about the book and Merrill Lynch first, and how it grew and how it imploded. I would imagine a lot of people in our audience are or formerly were customers of the Merrill Lynch brokerage. So first, why don't you talk a little bit about the firm itself. It started with this character, Charlie Merrill, long ago, who borrowed his first $10, it sounds like, to get in the brokerage business.
Well, thank you, Larry. You know, and character is the right word. He was an amazing guy. I was fortunate enough to know him as a young child, and my dad obviously was a partner and a colleague of his for 40 years. But, you know, he really represents the best in that entrepreneurial spirit that's been so important for our country. You know, he didn't graduate from college. He attended. He had this audacious idea of starting his own firm at the age of 29. But the thing that I trace through the book is not only was he a brilliant entrepreneur and a visionary, but he had a set of values and principles that started with the belief that the customer's interest always had to come first. And that was just paramount to everything he did. He passed it through to my father. My father passed it through to their successors. And I really believe that it was that culture that was built on those principles that enabled Merrill to grow and innovate and develop. And it was unfortunately the changing of the culture that almost brought it down.
Yeah, what a concept. The customer is always first.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the culture first and Merrill Lynch in their heyday. So first off, I understand Merrill Lynch is 100 years old this year, started in January 1914, which is in itself quite a remarkable feat. But, you know, back in the day in 1914, I think the brokerage world was really dedicated towards the top 1% of the nation's wealthiest people. And my understanding is Merrill Lynch is really the group that brought Wall Street to Main Street and let the average person know that they too could own stocks. But tell us how they did that.
Sure. It's a fabulous story because actually, you know, up till 1939, you know, and after the crash of 29, it was the place for the 1%. People didn't think they could get a break. There were lots of conflicts of interest that existed. And Charlie Merrill actually had left the business for 10 years, sold it to E.A. Pierce in Chicago, where my father was a partner. And in 39, my dad called Charlie Merrill and tried to convince him to come back into the business and do business very differently. And that was the biggest sale of his life because Charlie bought it. And they did a few things. They really believed that first and foremost, they had to have the customer's interest first. They had to do away with conflict of interest. They did something very radical is they took brokers off of commission and they paid them a salary and a bonus based on how well they did for their clients. They separated research, you know, from investment banking to make sure that it was independent. They understood that the clients really didn't know how to invest, so they spent a tremendous amount of time and energy on educating the client about how to invest. And then, importantly, they started a training program for brokers, so before they were let loose on society, they actually had to go through some very detailed training. And that set the stage of bringing Wall Street to Main Street and thereby bringing Main Street to Wall Street that I think really helped to fuel the economy after World War II.
And how big did Merrill become? I dug out some figures, but let's hear your take on how big did Merrill become at its peak?
Well, you know, I think an important measurement, and this is also gets to part of the reason why the culture changed, because a new CEO convinced the board that everything was bad and needed to be radically changed. So if you look back at what Merrill was at the end of 2000, it was a global private wealth investment banking asset management firm that had a presence in, you know, 40 or 50 countries around the world, including the United States. It earned $3.8 billion. It had a return on equity of 24.2% that year. It had client assets under advisement of $1.5 trillion, and it had led the underwriting league tables, both debt and equity, for 48 consecutive quarters. Never done before and probably won't be done afterwards. So that's what the firm was in the end of 2000.
Now let's use that as a way to open the door and talk about Stan O'Neill and the firm that he inherited. You know, those are very impressive stats. I mean, Merrill was certainly in the top five of most of the important categories that mattered, and you weren't far from number one in any of those categories. So,
no, ironically, one category we weren't top five in was mortgage-backed securities.
That is ironic. So given that background, how was Stanley O'Neill able to convince the board that they had to make dramatic changes when he took over?
You know, that's really a good question. And I think what he did is he began to spin the story that Mother Merrill didn't stand for a family culture, which is what we all believe, but rather it was a soft culture. It was nepotistic. It needed to be radically changed. And, you know, the internet bubble burst in 2001, and then we had 9/11. So there was no question that, you know, changes were going to have to be made to get through a tough cycle. But what he did is he convinced the board that radical changes need to be changed. He cut deeply into the muscle, discarded much of our international private wealth business, cut into our investment banking relationship business, cut back dramatically on the U.S. private client business, and created short-term earnings with cost savings. And then, when the market did recover, and Merrill was lagging the performance of other people like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, and that's when he knew you couldn't rebuild those businesses that took decades. You had to jump into something that created short-term profitability, used a very healthy balance sheet, got into subprime mortgages, CDOs, and took the leverage of the company up to 34 or 35 to 1, and that's really what the problem became in 2007.
And Wynn, I think that's an important lesson for everybody in the audience, which is, you know, Merrill is famous for its four or five values principles, and I'll give you a chance to share those in a minute. But the broader landscape I want to paint is here you had a very successful firm. And after 9/11, the world changed, and some other folks were beginning to get some leeway on your way of doing things. And oftentimes a really hard thing and where culture and values help guide you and help you from making mistakes like getting into mortgage-backed securities is you say, you know what, we're going to continue to grow, we're going to continue to evolve, but we're going to stay true to who we are. And I think that's why Merrill has been around for 100 years. But boy, you can see how quickly things can dissolve in 6 years when you start to move away from your values, your culture, and your core.
Absolutely. You are spot on that. And, you know, I hope the business schools will talk more about values and cultures and principles and not just, you know, the technical aspect of running the business. And, you know, I hope that all boards, you know, will focus not only on the technical skills of a CEO, but the character of a CEO as well.
You know, it's funny you mention that because Stanley O'Neill, I believe, is a Harvard business school grad, right, which is one of the top business schools in the country.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, a very bright, a very able person. You know, you can't take that away. He was a very good CFO at Merrill Lynch. But, you know, it's interesting. He really had no interest in understanding the history. He had no appreciation for the culture, you know, redefined what that was. And unfortunately, in my opinion, was focused on short term, was greedy, and did not have the best interests of the firm in mind.
So you pretty much lay the demise of Merrill as it existed at Stan O'Neill's feet. But he's guided by a board of directors, and didn't that board of directors carry over from a different culture? And where was the board when he was reinventing Merrill and taking it down paths and getting it so over-leveraged?
You know, I'm very critical of the board collectively in my book as well. And yes, they were accountable and they let this happen on their watch. But it's also interesting, if you take a look at the board that existed in 2007, with one exception, they were all directors, different directors than existed in 2001. And too often I think the CEO has too much control on the selection of the board. This may be the time in America for us to follow more of the European model where you have a non-executive chairman who really runs the board, as opposed to the CEO who's holding the title of both chairman and CEO.
Well, and indicative of the importance of the role of the board is Stanley O'Neill had a chance to sell Merrill Lynch before really the mortgage-backed securities and that issue fully came to light. And the words I heard back in the day was about $100 billion. Versus the $50 billion fire sale that it ended up being sold to like 12 months later, really because he could not get the support of the board to sell the firm.
Well, you know, I don't really know, you know, how true that was or wasn't true. But, you know, I think the opinion of me and all the others who were there for so many years is Merrill should not have been sold and did not have to have been sold and could have been an acquirer as it had been in prior years. But it got into a position where it really faced failure. And fortunately, John Thain, who succeeded Stan O'Neill, you know, in our opinion, did the best he could and made a deal with Bank of America, which I think is going to actually turn out to be a very good story. I think it's going to be a great acquisition for Bank of America. And, you know, currently, Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner & Smith still exists as a subsidiary under the brand name, and the private wealth side of it is doing very well, and the leaders of it are embracing the history and the culture, which gives me a lot of confidence for the future.
Well, and when another rumor that I've heard out in the financial, I work in the financial world as well, is that you and a group of investors actually approached Bank of America like a year after they bought it and tried to buy Merrill Lynch back.
You know, we did, and we thought that Bank of America was going through some difficult times. They might have capital issues that, you know, they might be interested in, you know, spinning off all or even some of it. And we knew that there were a group of employees and a group of investors who very much stood behind that.
Yeah, I think that would, though there's still some bumps in the road, I think, just settling all the government cases for what happened during that period of time. I think going forward, that would have worked out really well if you had been able to put that together.
It would have, but you know, now the given reality is it's there, it's doing very well. And I think as long as they continue to let Merrill, you know, run itself under its own brand and operate as it has, and they value the principles, it can do very well.
Okay. Now, in the time remaining, let's switch to a couple other topics. Well, first of all, just is the way you can now trade stocks online for $8.95 or $7.95 or whatever, has it, to use the cliche, leveled the playing field for all investors, even beyond what Merrill was able to do 100 years ago? Or is it still an insider's game where Ma and Pa on Main Street can't get a break?
Well, I think that, you know, Ma and Pa can get a break, but, you know, there's so much volatility in the market right now that it makes people awfully nervous. And I do think the one thing that is always going to exist is the need for good, sound financial advice. And when people ask me, you know, what should you do? I say the first and most important thing is find somebody who's good, who's trustworthy, who's honest. And if you're not a professional yourself, you know, really turn that responsibility over to a good advisor. And there are lots and lots of them out there at many different firms, including Merrill Lynch.
So the idea is you can't read things in the newspaper and act on them yourself. You really do need somebody who's operating at a higher level.
You really do. And, you know, the most important things are to understand, you know, what your risk profile is, you know, what your time horizon is, and then build a portfolio and invest for the long run and not for the short-term trade. Short-term traders rarely work out long-term.
Yeah, I completely agree with those points. You know, finding somebody that's an expert in their field and more important, in my view, is honest and trustworthy is really what you're looking for. And there's plenty of guys that can say, oh, look how well I did last year or the year before. But that's really not what you're looking for. What you're really looking for is long-term. Who's going to help you meet your goals?
Absolutely.
So let me build on Larry's previous question. You know, and broadly, the question has to do with what do you think Wall Street needs to do to regain the confidence of Main Street? And I want to interject a point as kind of a starting place, and that is, so here Stanley O'Neill takes over Merrill Lynch, runs it for 6 or 7 years, over-leverages the balance sheet, makes some very bad decisions. The board decides it's time for Stanley to leave. And yet they give him a $165 million severance package. I think people
are morally reprehensible.
Isn't it? Yeah. I think people on Main Street are like, they just want nothing to do with that. And so how do we regain the confidence and trust of Main Street?
I think it's going to take a while. You know, in many ways, we're witnessing what my dad and Charlie Merrill witnessed back in 1939. And it's going to take a lot of time and I think effort for Main Street to regain that confidence. You know, it's interesting that a lot of the Wall Street firms went from being run by client people to traders. And I'll give you an example. Merrill was always run by somebody who grew up as an advisor, was an office manager, and was always attached to a client. Goldman Sachs used to be run by John Whitehead and John Weinberg, who were client people on the investment banking side. And it's interesting to hear how people talk. Client people talk about customers. Traders talk about counterparties. So Wall Street needs to get away from the trading mentality and back into the client mentality, in my opinion, if it's going to regain the credibility of Main Street.
Yeah, good points. Good points. I agree. I mean, you want to have your firm working for one person, and that's you. You don't want them working both sides of the trade.
You got it. And, you know, also we have to be a little careful to whitewash all of Wall Street. You know, Wall Street isn't just those traders. It's not just the wolf on Wall Street. There are a lot of really good people in Park City, offices in Park City, who are representing clients, and they still are part of Wall Street, and I think the really good, solid part of Wall Street.
Okay, well, let's switch to something way more fun now, at least for people who live in Park City. You're part of an investment group that owns Sugarbush, and you're chair and CEO of that of Summit Ventures, which owns Sugarbush Resort. Is this a midlife crisis kind of thing? You wanted to get into the ski business? How'd that come about?
No, it's a little bit serendipitous. Just as I was leaving Merrill Lynch, there was an opportunity to buy it. It was a failing company. We saw a tremendous, you know, value here, and so we jumped in. And, you know, there's a great connection with Park City. I love skiing out there, by the way, but Stein Erickson was the ski director at Sugarbush in the early 60s.
Wow.
And so we have a great connection with Stein. He came back for our, you know, 45th birthday here. I visited him out there. So there's a wonderful connection between, you know, Deer Valley, Park City, and Sugarbush. And for me, this is a second career, which, you know, I love doing. And by being an owner, I got to ski 130 days last year.
I think you're beating most people in Park City who pride themselves on the days they count. Well, what do you see in the ski business that you like? It you know, the last few years the talk has been of flat growth and of how expensive it's become, and it's outpriced middle America. And what do you see as the future of the ski business?
I'm very positive. You know, I think, you know, you could arguably say perhaps there are too many ski resorts, the number of people skiing here, and growth is flat. But I think there's a great opportunity to, you know, introduce people to the industry. The industry was built by baby boomers. We're all, you know, aging, but we're not dying, and we're skiing still. But there's a great opportunity to capture youth. We came up with a pass a couple of years ago called the 420 Pass for people 19 to 29, and we made it affordable so they couldn't really pass it up for $299, and we've really recaptured and grown that youth business who was falling out of the industry. So I think there are always innovative ways of growing businesses, adapting, changing. You know, we need to look at the new demographics in this country, to look at people of color, Asian Americans, make sure they're introduced in an affordable way so that they grow to love the sport like we do.
I think those are great points. And, you know, life throws you curveballs. I noticed when I was doing a little bit of background research for today's interview, you actually closed on the Sugarbush deal the day before September 11th. You had to be having big second thoughts 24 hours after you closed on the deal.
Oh, boy, talk about timing. And it was a very tough, first year. In fact, it took us 2 or 3 years to turn it around. And, you know, fortunately, I had the means. And I didn't have a board of directors. I didn't have a public company. So I could afford to invest and, you know, frankly, lose money for a few years and make those investments, which are, turned out to be very valuable. Now we're a healthy, growing company.
I saw some quotes on your thoughts about how companies make money and what comes first, service or profits. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that to our audience.
Oh, sure. You know, you have to build around that fundamental. And, you know, I stole Merrill Lynch's principles. Our principles here are the same as Merrill's. The guest interest comes first. You know, we focus on teamwork, respect for the individual, integrity, and community responsibility. And I think if you follow those and you build a good, successful enterprise, profits are going to come.
Okay, so what's your selling point over of New England skiing versus Western Rocky Mountain?
You're putting them on the spot now, Larry.
Oh, man, you're putting them on the spot now. But, well, you know, I will say that one thing we have at Sugarbush is we don't have as many powder days as you have out there, and sometimes we have a little bit colder weather, but we do have our powder days. We had 50 inches in February so far, and we have some terrific vertical. I've got 2,600 of vertical. We've got some really challenging trails as well as some, you know, good intermediate groomers, but it's awfully hard for me to compete with Park City on a bluebird day like it sounds like you're having today.
Yeah, well, fortunately, you guys are getting a lot of snow out there now. Wynn, we've got time for one last question, and I want to preface this with I really liked your dedication, and I hope someday somebody will say something similar about me that you said about your father, and if it's okay, I'm just going to read the first sentence of your dedication. And you say, this book is dedicated first to my father, a principled leader and a humble, generous man who lived his life with the highest integrity. And my last question is just tell us a little bit about your father, if you would.
Oh, he was a great man. And, you know, he died when I was very young. So I was 11 when he passed away. And he was ill with Parkinson's for about 4 years before that. So, you know, I knew him, but I really got to know him through the stories of others and through people that worked with him and people that knew him as an individual. And he really has been a guide to my life.
Well, that's a terrific way to end. Thanks so much for joining us. Interesting conversation on a couple of different topics. Winthrop Smith Jr. has been our guest. His book, Catching Lightning in a Bottle, How Merrill Lynch Revolutionized the Financial World. It's the story of Merrill Lynch, which is 100 years old and still kicking and doing well. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Wynn, thanks for joining us. I enjoyed our conversation.
My pleasure. Thank
okay,
you.
Well, let's take a look at the weather. It's going to be partly sunny, as you see, expecting a high of about 48 tonight with a low of 27. Slight chance, 20% chance throughout most of the weekdays, but then Thursday and Thursday night, we have a very good chance of a big storm coming
through. Supposed to be a doozy.
And we've heard that before, and we'll hold our breath and see how it develops over the next few days.
All right, and stay tuned. Coming up next, Main Street's got a new pub and grill, Rockin' Riley's, and we're going to have the manager of Rockin' Riley's as our next guest, Matt Green. Stay tuned, please.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. That was a fascinating conversation with Wynn Smith. He was actually chairman of Merrill Lynch for all ex-United States operations. So great story. It was nice to have him as a guest.
It's an example of Beth Fratkin's hard work as our producer to get guests like Winthrop Smith. He's been all over CNBC, Fox Business, Bloomberg, Wall Street Journal, everywhere else.
Indeed, he has.
It was fun
to have him on KPCW as well. Well, with us now in studio, we have Matt Green. He is the manager of Rockin' Riley's, which is on 4th and Main Street. And Matt, in my description here, it says that Rockin' Riley's is a Prohibition era speakeasy. Infused with mining history and a ski town flair. I haven't been there yet, but I'm looking forward to it. When did you guys open, and what are you hoping to do?
Well, we opened this last fall. We also did activate for Sundance last year and this year, which were both great. So we opened in the fall. We had our kitchen fully open in December, just in time for the season.
Right.
And, just a little to elaborate on the description, our model, we really focus on our food, fun, and a warm, welcoming ambiance.
And do you come from the restaurant, bar, pub business?
Yes, I grew up. My parents had a restaurant when I was young. And actually, to tie into your last guess, I grew up skiing Vermont, Sugar Bush, and then...
And now you get to ski here?
Exactly.
Well, that's funny. My parents owned a restaurant, too. And when I went to college, there was one thing I knew I did not want to do, which is run a restaurant. It's a lot of work. Tell us about your journey and why you decided you wanted to open your own restaurant.
Well, I've worked in restaurants my whole life. Went to school in Colorado, lived in various ski towns, Vail, Squaw Valley. Have been here for the last couple seasons. It's something that I really enjoy, the energy, the people. I've had jobs... desk jobs, and I just enjoy the energy of working in restaurants and hospitality.
So describe the building. You're in what old-timers would call the Memorial Building.
Yes.
Which less old-timers would call Harry O's and what newcomers would call Park City Live.
Yes.
So you're on the opposite side from O'Shucks?
Yes, we're on the uphill side of the Memorial Building. And the upstairs space, the last previous concept there was Tattoo. So the space has been empty for quite some years, but the space is really beautiful. We were really happy to find this location. It's right on the 50-yard line of Main Street. It's kind of where there's a lot of foot traffic, and it's where kind of all the action is. So we're really happy with the location.
So how do you take a blank slate, a restaurant occupied by someone else who's left and left years ago, and create ambiance and figure out what the theme is?
Well, the theme has already been established. There's another flagship location on the Sunset Strip in West Hollywood, and that is what ties in one of the brand elements, which is classic rock and roll music and sports. We have 9 flat screen TVs. We go into the space, and our focus is to make it feel warm, welcoming. So a lot of dark wood, Edison lights hanging from the ceiling. We have our own custom wallpaper that we put up as well, high top tables. So the focus is when we go into the space, we want people to feel warm and welcome, not have it be cold or hard.
Right. And are you involved in the other restaurant in Hollywood as well?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So those are, spread out pretty far. between one another? How do you manage the operations in two different states?
Well, our location on the Sunset Strip has – we have a very strong management team that we've set up. We've been open for over 2.5 years. So now the focus of the team is on this location here since we have just recently opened up.
And is the game plan to go nationwide to different tourist locations? Like could you see Orlando – it sounds like the concept could work in Orlando, Florida as well.
Yeah. Well, from the very beginning, the focus was to create a brand that had a lot of depth, a backstory. The model focuses on food. You know, the beverage side is an element that that everybody can do and not differentiate too much. So we really focus on the food, the service, the brand, and the ambiance. And those are the things that we really have control of and are differentiating factors from other locations.
And what I like about the food is it's a lot of it is what you would expect in an Irish pub. It's not $32 entrees. It's sandwiches. It's $10 meals.
That is our price point. We wanted a very reasonable price point, so everything is right around $10. There's a lot of modern progressive takes to Irish food as well, like the corned beef sliders. We do truffle sliders with a little truffle oil on there. We really also want to focus on having healthy items as well. So it's not all fried, heavy food. We have, you know, our beaten burrata salad. We have a kale and quinoa salad as well because we want it to, these days and age, people want to eat healthy. They want to feel good about what they put in their bodies. And also the female clientele as well isn't going to eat fish and chips every day.
So you brought a couple copies of your menu, and Larry's got one in front of him. I don't have one in front of me, but do you guys have a gluten-free hamburger? I always chuckle when I see that. How do you make a hamburger bun gluten-free? But apparently they can.
We don't, but that is something that we'll look into. As far as gluten-free vegan items like the kale and quinoa salad would basically satisfy any diet, and it's delicious as well. It's got a honey vinaigrette dressing and candied walnuts, and it's just very delicious and very filling.
So yep. When you came in, you said you had activated Rock and Riley's for the previous two seasons. What does that mean? Does that mean you had a location just for a month, like during Sundance?
That means we had an event permit for Sundance. So we didn't have permanent licensing. So okay. it was just
in the same location or
yes.
Somewhere else on Main Street?
Yeah, in the same location.
And did you do that as a way to say, hey, I wonder if this concept would work here in Park City, as kind of a way to test the waters?
We were fully committed out of the gate. We were fully committed even before we did the first Sundance.
Okay. Well, talk a little bit about marketing in the digital age and specifically, a lot of sites now review restaurants. And I went to Yelp, for example, and looked up Rock and Riley's, and you had a scathing 1-star review. But then you had about 10 4 and 5-star, thought everything was great. How do you deal with having third parties post anything they want, like that one red herring 1-star review that shows up on a website? Does that hurt or does that really not matter?
You know, it does. We take all reviews like that very seriously. We actually reach out and write to people. Every single Yelp review that isn't a glowing Yelp review, we take every guest very seriously, and especially if it's somebody local that didn't have a glowing experience, we want to reach out and invite them back in and make sure that they do and kind of give us another opportunity.
But they're anonymous, aren't they? How do you find them?
We can through the admin login to Yelp. You can write them a letter. So it is anonymous, but Yelp allows you to reach out to them and write them a letter.
Okay, and is it something you worry about? Is it something if you're in the restaurant business now or in the service business, you have to watch online reviews
Yes, constantly. Our approach and our goal is to satisfy every single guest, and if you don't and something does fall through the cracks and you get reviews like that, the great part is that you can reach out to them and try to rectify the situation. And very often the people are very receptive to it and they will come back in and a lot of times they'll change those reviews or at least appreciate the fact that that you took the time and you cared.
And I do want to reinforce that there was only one of those, and it was the real red herring.
Yeah.
What about sites like Facebook, Pinterest, all the rest? Are you active there, and can you engage someone who isn't a customer, or is that for regular customers you already have who you communicate that way with?
Absolutely. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Facebook now has a lot of focus on advertising, so you can very specifically target demographics or people that like similar concepts, are in your age profile, location. So we reach out and we find a lot of new guests and customers through Facebook. We also send out emails about once a month, letting our guests know our promotions, food specials, and upcoming events as well.
I guess what I'm getting at is the days of having cold beer and a good burger and that's enough are really over.
Yeah, the market's just too competitive to sit back and watch social media pass in front of you.
Do you think that would be the case if we were not a tourist town? If most of your business was locals?
I think that the social media and digital advertising aspect is going to give anybody an advantage who seeks it out and looks for it. These days and age, most people do have Facebook. They check it constantly, and it's growing faster and faster. So,
right. So would you say your marketing attention is split 50-50 between the digital and then the traditional media, the park record, the radio station?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the third time we've been on KPCW, and we get people coming in constantly that are like, oh, I heard you you were on the pledge drive, and so we wanted to stop in, or people read the article on the park record, or read an article in the Tribune down in Salt Lake. So I think in this area especially, the print, radio, media is very strong because people do have a stronger following for radio, TV, and print.
Right. You know, Larry, it's an interesting point because when I go on vacation, other than the trip back to my hometown in Cleveland, I didn't have to break out Yelp. I went to the same pizza joint I went to when I was in high school, which was fun. But when I go to a new town, Yelp is how I decide where I'm going to eat unless, I know somebody in that town.
I often do as well.
Yeah. It's a great service. And it's nice to hear that if you do get a review that's not – that you feel is not reflective of the overall experience, that you can reach out to that guest and try to make it right.
Absolutely.
Now, in the restaurant and bar business in Utah specifically – There are quirks in Utah liquor laws, and they're maddening to some people and not to others. By and large, did you have any hesitation, your investment group, to coming to Utah and trying to make money off liquor sales and food?
I don't think so. It's an equal playing field for everybody. So, we recognize that the UDABC has been very professional and fair and upfront. So they've been great to work with. The City Hall at Park City has been amazing as well. So we're really happy to be here. We've been coming out here skiing for practically a decade now, and I've been coming out here since high school to ski Little Cottonwood Canyon. So we knew what we were getting into, and I think it's been a good experience.
And now you get to live here, and it's the ski resorts are in your backyard. Well, Matt, thanks for joining us. Our guest is Matt Green, manager of the Rockin' Riley's, which is on 4th and Main Street, a new Irish pub. And according to Huffington Post, where's that quote I saw? The most popular Irish pub in America. That's quite an endorsement.
For St. Patrick's Day, we had the most Google searches in the previous week than any other Irish pub in the United States.
There you go, back to the importance of the internet and social media.
Indeed, and it's the only Irish pub I've seen that has Irish nachos.
They're amazing. They're amazing. People go crazy for them.
It just does not seem to go with a... Irish food.
Well, we'll have to go sample that later
also,
this week, Larry.
Talking about healthy food, I don't see concannon on your menu.
We
either.
Do have concannon.
Do you?
We
okay.
absolutely do.
All right. Very fine. Well, it's not exactly the healthiest way to make a potato, but but it sure is good. Okay. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be back to talk about tea next.
Just because it's white outside doesn't mean you can't stay green.
Listen to This Green Earth every Tuesday at 9 a.m.
Discussing environmental issues from methane gas to moose habitat.
Air quality to fire ecology.
And bark beetles to eating bugs.
That's This Green Earth, brought to you by Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
Republic Services.
Habitat for Humanities Restore.
Rocky Mountain Power.
And Vail Resorts.
This is Craig McCarthy with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Do you know that members of the Park City Chamber Bureau have access to a wide array of benefits that give them an edge in the local marketplace? We offer members-only insurance and discount programs, business-to-business networking opportunities, and much more. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to Mound Money. We're going to switch gears from Irish pubs to tea. Cold beer to warm tea. The studio is starting to smell delightful. Our guest is Marcy Gorsch. She is the owner of Wasatch Tea Company. She brought us in some samples. But more important, she's here to tell us about her new location, which is in Snow Creek Shopping Center. Laguerre's, Larry, am I pronouncing it correct?
Oh, yeah.
Which is the old Laguerre's space. Marcy, welcome to Mound Money.
Thank you.
So how'd you come up with the idea of opening a tea store here in Park City? To my knowledge, it's probably the only one. Is that correct?
It is. We moved here 2.5 years ago from Iowa, and I had thought about doing it there, but we were thinking of moving, so I decided to wait. And when we got here, there wasn't a good place to have tea. And so last January, I decided it was time. So I found some courses, and I became a certified American Tea Master, so a tea sommelier, and I am finishing up becoming a master tea blender. So I do all my own blends as well.
And I know in the wine side, the sommelier is a very difficult designation to get. What is it like on the tea side?
It's quite challenging. It was a 3-day hands-on course in San Diego, and then the rest of it's been online. It had 40 different teas to taste and evaluate, and a final one that all I knew was where it was purchased. And from there, I had to figure out what tea it was, how to brew it.
So very similar. I know they give them, they blindfold them, and they have to tell them where the wine, not only what type of wine it is, but where it was grown, and give them all this other background.
Yeah, so it's challenging. And then
always have been a tea lover to be able to go from not being a tea master to a tea master in the course of a week. You must have had a lot of experience already with teas.
Well, I took the course in May, and I just finished last month.
Okay.
So it's a long process.
You and your
process.
Husband were drinking a lot of tea over the summer.
I drank a lot of tea, and so did my kids.
So to have a tea company, are you simply buying bulk tea and breaking it down, or are you creating blends of various varieties of tea? I would imagine there must be hundreds or thousands of different teas out there.
There are. And so I am focused on sourcing organic teas, which is a much smaller market because not as many are grown organically. And then I bring them in and I do all my own blends. So I don't source blends from anybody. So
tell us about your location. Is it someplace somebody can sit down and have a nice conversation, comfy chairs, and enjoy a glass of tea? Or do you go there to get the tea leaves and then basically leave?
No, it's a comfortable space. You can come and sit. I have a counter that looks out onto Payday and King's Crown. And then I have two tables that seat 6 to 9 people apiece, depending.
I think that's really important. You know, I was listening to the CEO of Starbucks talk a while ago, and he would say that he's not in the coffee business, surprisingly. He would describe his business as he is a place for people to visit, someplace that's not work and not home. And I think that's brilliant. And I used to spend a fair amount of time reading at Starbucks. I still do. And I just wonder, how can they make money? It's very expensive space with people like me hanging out there for an hour. But the reality is there's so many people that come in and out because they don't have time to do that. So I think having a comfortable space is a really important piece of the overall recipe.
Yeah, I'd like people to come and have a meeting there if they'd like, or just sit and relax for a while.
And are you open 7 days a week?
I'm closed Sunday.
Gotta give a girl a day off.
That's right. That's right.
Well, do you ever see tea becoming like coffee, like a Starbucks, where people zip in and take a hot tea to go?
I do, and especially iced things. My ice maker is coming this week, and I'm excited. I do a homemade limeade that I put matcha, which is a ground Japanese green tea powder, in it, and it's full of antioxidants. So it's a really nice natural energy boost. And so for things like that, I think it would take off. People can come in, get it, and take it on their way with them.
And I think the trends are favoring you, right? I mean, I drink too much coffee. I've got a friend that's a cardiologist, and he's like, look, Doug, you're active. You watch your weight. You know, the one thing I would tell you to do is, you know, cut back on your coffee. And he said, you know, really, it'd be much better for you if you drank tea instead of coffee. And I'm starting to see that more and more.
Yeah, and my husband's a huge coffee drinker, iced coffee all day long. He loves it. And when I took this course, I introduced him to pu'er, which is a fermented black tea, which is very earthy. So the coffee drinker in him loves it. It's now become his favorite tea.
I want to like tea, and it's an acquired taste for me. So do you find that most folks that do drink coffee, if they give it a chance over a couple of weeks, they can develop a taste for the tea and make the switch?
They can, especially when the tea's brewed correctly. A lot of people brew their green teas especially too hot, and so it's very bitter and unpleasant. If you bring the temperature down, shorten your brew time, it brings out the natural sweetness of the tea.
Now, you say you source organically grown teas. Are they from all over the world? Is most tea from Asia? I looked at one of these samples, and it said it's a Moroccan tea.
It is a Moroccan blend that I've done, which means it's a mint and gunpowder tea, actually. So it's not actually from Morocco. Yeah. So the teas are from all over. It got the name because it sounds like little gunpowder pellets, because it's so tightly rolled. That's how it got the name.
Okay. But it's not all Asian tea.
It's from all over.
Is tea grown in North America?
There is one place that grows tea, and I believe it's in Georgia.
Hmm.
Okay. But tea's not really grown in the U.S.
So how do you... How can you make certain it's organic, that it's not been fertilized and processed?
Most other countries have much stricter organic guidelines than we do. And so it's certified by the European Union and other certifications to ensure that it's organically grown.
So, you know, one time, kids are fascinating, and I heard you say you have kids as well. And my daughter once, you know, she didn't know that coffee came from coffee beans, Larry. And she saw them grinding.
She thought it came from cans?
She wasn't sure, right? And she asked me, she's like, how did they get the idea to, you know, make a drink out of this coffee bean? She was just fascinated by that. Tell us, and I'm sure in your sommelier course, they told you the history of teas. Tell us, how did tea get started? How did people come up with the idea initially to start drinking tea?
Well, one of the myths in China is that a person was sitting under a tree and he had a cup of water. And this leaf floated into his water, and it flavored it, and he enjoyed the flavor.
That sounds logical.
And so that's how tea began in China. And then it grew. It went from China to Japan and other countries. But
what's the real story? It's probably nowhere near as interesting.
No, it was medicinal. Okay. You know, they found that it had many health benefits, and so they started drinking it.
So do you know the story of coffee by chance?
I don't.
Because I don't know if this is true or not, but I'm sure somebody in our audience does. What I was told was there were shepherds that were taking care of their sheep, and the sheep used to eat the beans, and the older sheep all of a sudden would perk up and have a lot more energy and activity. And it was actually a monk, the story I was told, that was the shepherd. And then they went from that and started eating the beans, but they got belly aches and decided to try it with water, blah, blah, blah. So if anybody knows the true story of how coffee started or even tea, give us a holler. It'd be a fascinating story.
I'm sure you could Google it.
Yeah, that would probably work too. Wouldn't be as much fun as giving a listener a chance to call in.
Yeah, okay. So mostly you're selling tea in... In small containers. Is it sold by the ounce?
It's sold by the bag. I have four different size bags that you can get it in.
And what kind of price range? Is this, I presume, to get a custom blended organic tea, it's not like buying a box of Lipton's at the supermarket.
It's not. A small bag of a tea ranges between $9 and $4. Just depends on the blend that's in there, because the different teas and herbs weigh different amounts.
And how many cups of tea can you get from that?
Out of that, you'll get 10 to 15, but you can brew it 2 to 3 times. So,
really?
Yeah. When you get really high quality tea leaves, you can brew it multiple times. It's part of the benefit of it.
So when you get a neophyte in the store, like I would be, and they say, hey, I've heard tea's supposed to be healthier for me, I want to try switching over to tea, what kind of advice would you give them?
I would point them. I have all my teas out in little jars so people can see them, open them, smell them. And I would ask them what types of things they like. If you like something stronger, you'll want to go more towards an oolong or a black tea to start, because it's more where your palate's at. If you like lighter things, there's lots of herbal varieties as well, and I have a lot of green teas.
Now, do you have, I know my wife drinks decaffeinated tea. Do you have, because you're organic in that, is that something you can offer, or there's no decaffeinated teas?
Decaffeinated, like a decaffeinated black, I don't carry because of the chemical process it undergoes,
right.
But I have many caffeine-free varieties.
They're just naturally caffeine-free.
Naturally caffeine-free.
Okay, interesting.
Okay, and one last question. How's business so far? Have people found you?
People are finding me. It's exciting. Each day I have new people who wander in, so.
And you're building a regular clientele?
I do. I have some people that come back regularly. They try it and they like it and they come back, get some for themselves, get some for friends.
Well, I'll be bringing my wife down. I think I'll get some brownie points for doing that. So she'll be impressed that I know that there's the Wasatch Tea Company. Again, Marcy Gorsch is our guest. She's the owner of Wasatch Tea Company. It's her facility is in the Snow Creek Shopping Center, where the old Laguerre's used to be. Thank you for joining us, Marcy.
Thank you.
And we'll be back to wrap up Mountain Money after this.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you. KPCW presents Park City Stories, hosted by Leslie Thatcher and heard on Friday throughout the day. Supported by Sea2Ski, property management and concierge service provider for Park City's vacation homeowners. Sea2SkiProperties.com. Park City Ski Boot, dedicated to the individual performance ski boot fit. 1100 Iron Horse Drive, ParkCitySkiBoot.com. And Alan Schoenberger Ski Studio, helping Park City learn to ski one turn at a time. 435-640-3103. SkiStudioPC.com.
And welcome back to Mountain Money. I want to thank our great sponsors who make this show happen every week: Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, the Iron Mountain Group, the Park City Chamber, Prudential Real Estate, and San Francisco Design. They've all been with us quite some time, and we appreciate their help in bringing great public affairs programs like Mountain Money to you. And interesting variety of guests from Winthrop Smith. You know, one thing we didn't mention was he was in the running to be chairman of Merrill Lynch International.
Correct.
Yeah. But he was in the running to run the whole thing in the U.S.
And sometimes it's funny how life works out. I believe he sold all his stock after he decided to leave Merrill, and that turned out financially to be a very good decision for him.
Well, it allowed him to get into the fun business, the ski business, although I don't know how fun that is on a daily basis. But he did say he got in over 100 days of skiing each season at Sugar Bush. So thanks very much for joining us. Our guests were Winthrop Smith, and that book is called Catching Lightning in a Bottle, How Merrill Lynch Revolutionized the Financial World, if you're someone who's interested in going in-depth on that topic. And then we had Matt Green, manager of Rock and Riley's, and Marcy Gorsch. Interesting to know there's that much variety in tea out there.
Well, we're lucky to live in a small town like this. We have more than our fair share of different restaurants and different service providers. And my wife, who drinks tea, will be glad to know there's a tea shop in town.